Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are going to have a conversation about what happened over the last year and what may be coming to us this coming year. It's been a very interesting year as we wind down here in the last of our live shows for 2010. And next week we have incredibly great new shows. Some wonderful people from this community coming in and bringing their favorite holiday music and great conversation taking place that next week. People like Leah Gilmore and John Carney, who's the first violinist for the Symphony Orchestra, and Keith Covington, who had owned the Haven Lounge, and Milton Duggar and Ed Polichuk, and just Tom Hall, who runs Choral Arts. It's going to be a great week of good music and talk. But today we're going to talk about what happened to this hour. What's been going on the last year? What are the biggest stories that we've missed or think that are the most important? Where we're going to go in the next year? We want to get your thoughts at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Here right now in the studio is Bob Summerbee, who is editor of the Daily Howler. He's been on my show for the last 17 years or so. Yes, it's been that long, Bob, as you've been coming on the show. It's scary, isn't it?
Well, it's surprising.
And joining us by phone, because we do not have high-speed rail to get people back and forth, who came up from Washington, D.C. to be on the show today and has been stuck in traffic for hours, is LaToya Peterson, editor of racialissues.com and a freelance writer. And you've also heard her as she substitute host for Michael Eric Dyson on his program as well. LaToya Peterson, welcome. Good to have you, too.
Hey, thank you. I should be in the studio in about 15 minutes.
Okay.
We're on St. Paul somewhere.
And you left a long time ago.
Yeah, we left at 3. everywhere. So, yeah, good on that one, not connecting D.C. and Baltimore in a nice interview.
Really?
This
really
is kind of a planes, trains, and automobiles thing.
We've been through farmland. We were trying to take the back routes. We went past the place called Hip Hop Chicken. Like, I don't know what to do at this point. I'm like, I just need to get to the studio. That's all I need.
You will be here in a moment.
Yes.
But let me get you both. Lotel, you can start and go to Bob. And tell us, when you reflect on this last year, what have been kind of the most important events, whether they've been thrown out in the headlines or not, that we should contemplate as we go, as this year comes out?
Wow, there's a ton. I mean, there's the huge shifts in the music industry, all of the new technological revelations that went out this year with, you know, the embrace of tablet PCs and changing how people are getting digital media, radio, stuff like that. And then there's also all the political stuff. I feel like this was a really a big political year in terms of fighting about everything from healthcare to the Dream Act, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and having the nation really engaged in politics, though not necessarily in a positive way. I feel like those were the big themes of the year.
Bob Summerbee.
Yeah, I'd say it was a very poor year. Just a bad... bad year. Not a good one. Not a good year.
This was not a very good year on many levels.
I don't know when there's been a year when I began to feel so strongly. You know, we're just really a sinking ship in this country.
We're the United States of America.
We're just a joke. We're a big clown college. You know, we're and I have to say, I mean, and I have a fairly specialized, noxious view of it. I mean, the way I see it, I'm sort of a liberal progressive who's increasingly hating all other liberals and progressives, which doesn't make other liberals and progressives like me. But here's what I see. I mean, I think we're increasingly a society where the 1% are at war with the 99%, and we, the 99%, are just constantly getting tricked into fighting with each other over relatively trivial things, like on our side how much we hate Sarah Palin, you know, how bad her reality show was last Sunday night. We now have our own sort of liberal channels that encourage us to be furious at the other side all the time. And it's understandable that we get tricked into this and that we might want to go this way, but the 1% can just destroy the 99% as long as the 99% keep arguing with you, as long as we break up into two warring tribes. So to me, this year has been the year of the rise of tribalism on my side of the aisle. And I just think I understand it. I just think it's a losing approach, and it's, I just think it's a killer.
LaToya, what do you think about that, about the tribalism that Bob posits?
Totally agree. I mean, the tribalism is what's killing our country right now, where we can't see where we can't necessarily see how these types of staying separate is hurting us, and it's hurting us so much because, as you know, as we just said, it's the 1% that's having a banner year. I was on the Dyson show yesterday, and we're interviewing one of the economic writers for the Huffington Post. And he was like, the outlook sucks. Everybody is having a terrible year, except for big business. They're doing great. You know, they're back on target. They're having great profits. The banks are doing well. It's the rest of us that are suffering. And that acknowledgement doesn't seem to be coming from any quarter of government or anything. So I feel like you would want to say, you know, this is the year for the citizens' revolution. This is really kind of like the year of the citizen apathy. Like, I cannot deal. I cannot show up at these polls in 2010, as we saw, you know, Mark, that night at Bus Boys and Sewage. Like, we just were like, I can't deal anymore. I'm going to watch reality TV. I'm going to tune out. Reality is just too depressing.
I've been watching a lot of movies myself. I'm going to be honest. Not really. But see, and here's what I think. Let's say now, healthcare was a gigantic issue from last year going into this year.
Right.
Everyone in the 99% is getting ripped. You know, I've told you this before, so, you know, stop me. Everyone in the 99% is getting ripped off on healthcare. Conservatives are getting ripped off. Liberals and progressives are. Everyone's getting ripped off except the 1% or the 2%. Or, and yet, as long as we keep fighting with each other over. Now, there are some fights that are worth having, but there are a lot of fights that aren't worth having. And as I watch the liberal web and liberal cable, I just see us constantly getting into fights that really aren't worth having, be encouraged to get into fights that aren't worth having, be encouraged to get distracted onto how much we hate Sarah Palin and the stupid thing she said this week. And as long as we minions are all, you know, fighting with each other over this stuff, the people who are increasingly taking control of the culture are just going to increasingly take control of the culture. And it's just that simple. Now, you know, there will be occasional liberal victories and occasional conservative victories, but the overall arc of the last 30 years is very clear, and it's the rise of, I said the 1%, it's really the 0.1%, but the rise of big interests and the concentration of wealth and power at the top increasingly. And we're fighting over, you know, pick the stupid thing that's driving clicks and eyeballs today. You know, whatever it is, there's always something.
Folks, what do you think? 410-319-8888. I think we just lost LaToya. Maybe she's pulling up, or maybe that's her right now again. 410-319-8888. What do you think about what Bob and LaToya are saying, and what do you think about this year that we've just had, 2010? Was it a great year? Was it a year of this horrible internal warfare that's kind of tearing this country apart? Is there another way around this? What do we see for the future? What are your thoughts? 410-319-8888. As we wind our way to 2 days before Christmas and almost time for New Year's and Kwanzaa come around the corner, what do you think? 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. What do we do, though? I mean, you know, and I think what you said about healthcare is right. I was thinking about just this person, our own little company. In order to afford healthcare for us and our little teeny company, production company, that produces the Mark Steiner Show and the Anthony McCarthy Show, and we do a bunch of other work as well. But to keep us going, the only way we can afford it is by affording healthcare where it costs each one of us $2,500 before the insurance kicks in. Now, that's a lot of money. Unless you're part of the 1%. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean.
And, you know, and it's insane. And so, but instead we are battling among ourselves. But what do you do about that? I mean, what is that? Because we are such a divided nation. And some of it's race, and some of it's class, and some of it's our view of history, our view of America can be very different.
Mm-hmm.
And how you get beyond that,
yeah, well,
to have a different
conversation. Yeah, I mean, but some of it is the desire to fight, you know, and the desire to fight not in a constructive way. You know, my view of this, you know, I started the Daily Howler in 1998 when there was no liberal web, or there really wasn't much of a web at all. I mean, I was actually one of the first handful of political websites. And, you know, my view of the 90s was the liberal world was off sleeping in the woods while various forces just chewed first Clinton, then Gore alive, and they put George Bush in the White House. I mean, there's no question the 20 months of nonsense aimed at Al Gore as a candidate, elected George, or whatever you want to say, put George Bush in the White House. Now, during that whole period, the liberal world was just non-existent, really. The liberal world largely checked out. And my view is, you know, Iraq sort of began to produce the resurgence of a liberal world. There's now a liberal web. There's liberal cable. There's even a little bit of liberal radio. But, boy, I never would have dreamed when the liberal world came back to life that we had, you know, I have to say we often, it seems to me, we're developing structures that are just, that really are modeled on the ludicrous structures the conservative world built in talk radio and cable, the sort of the ridiculous structures that existed on the other side. I never would have dreamed how much, in my view, so many liberals just want to be, we can be that dumb too. I mean, really, that's sort of the way it strikes me, and I know that's sort of a rude way of putting it. But it's just depressing. I don't know. I mean, I just think you have to urge people to understand you can't win. Liberals will never win if we're still, and progressives will never win if we're stuck in this war of the all against all on every silly issue. Because power wants us to do that. I mean, that's divide and conquer.
Well, Latoya, before you get here and have to jump out of the car to run up the steps.
Okay.
Chime in on that.
I think that there's a big vacuum of leadership. So I feel like the idea, just in general, being a liberal, you got to think about how difficult that is, because we're drawing a huge, huge tent. To be a conservative, you have to want to maintain the status quo. To be a liberal, we want to take things in different directions, and we don't necessarily agree on what those directions are. Feminists have their own agenda. Marxists have their own agenda. Communists have their own agenda. And we're all trying to unite under this idea of being liberal or being progressive, but we all have very different ideas of how we achieve that end goal and what compromises are accepted and what compromises are acceptable. And so, again, but for me in 2010, like, the thing that stood out the most to me was that the largest gathering of, like, liberal energy was around a comedian. We have Jon Stewart's March on Washington, which, you know, captured all this attention and, you know, had this huge size and all people coming through. And at the same time, I was like, well, what did we do that for? It was a joke. It was fun. And it appears that we don't have the political will, the political might to translate that into real action. And that's what's scary, I think.
Well, it took Jon Stewart this week to drive the first responders bill, sort of. I mean, everyone's saying
he really did drive it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
No one was covering the first responders bill, not the liberal media, not the conservative media. And the conservative media would not say it was Republicans who were opposing it. They wouldn't even touch that.
Right, not the mainstream media.
Not the mainstream. The mainstream media didn't hit it hard. And he pushed it hard.
Yeah.
The only other thing that I think I heard push really hard was Amy Goodman on Democracy Now.
Now, there was a lot going on this past week, so it's not like you can expect any individual person to do everything all at once. So, you know, you can't really come down on Rachel Maddow or Keith Olbermann for not doing it. Why did Jon Stewart have to do it? You know, there were a lot of things happening all at once. But,
part of that is also the decline of journalism, too, though, in terms of what type of information we as a people are demanding.
Mm-hmm.
Is being delivered, particularly when cost and profit are huge, huge parts of informing the public. You know, talk radio might not be informative, but it's profitable. Screaming heads isn't informative, but it's profitable. And so that shift has also occurred, that where people are just less aware of what issues are going on, because our news is full of things like, you know, checking out the malls at Black Friday and on Christmas versus, you know, the bills that are passing in the House and what's happening.
Let's go to the phones. 410-319-8888. What do you think, folks? You just heard Latoya Peterson, editor of racialicious.com, and who sits in also for Michael Eric Dyson. Bob Swinaby, editor of the Daily Howler. We look at this past year. What kind of year was 2010? What will 2011 be? What does it portend for us? 410-319-8888. And Keith, you're on the air.
How you doing, Mark?
Well, welcome.
I would like to say to your caller that I'm a liberal. I enjoy it. I enjoy it for the fundamental right that I don't think everything should be on a conservative bet. My case in question is these bills that Obama just passed, just signed, and everything like that. Do you think that if George Bush was still in the White House, that he would have got that kind of a drama from the Republican Congress. No, he wouldn't. No, he wouldn't. This whole thing to me this year that I've seen is that there's no civility in politics at all. I don't want to bring up racism as a factor, but there's something going on when the most simplest little things can't get done. They want to talk about bipartisanship and things like that. No, it's not. It's all about the conservative movement saying, well, we don't want you, if you don't do this, we're going to cut off people's unemployment. Unemployment during the Christmas holidays, I have never heard anything so draconian since the Vikings were here on Earth. And then I enjoy being different, to be able to challenge the conservative principles. Everybody is not like Senator Sam Brownback that lives in Kansas, and all our children don't walk through wheat fields every day. It's not like that. It's a cold world, a diverse world. And I think that's the main problem with the conservative movement I have, is that they don't really understand diversity. Thank you.
This is what you said is important. I think it's important for us to kind of wrestle a bit with it. I think that when you think about the divide America's in and the lack of civility and I think that on the one hand, Bob, what you were saying earlier, I agree with you about the absurdity of always focusing on Sarah Palin, attacking Sarah Palin. It's a waste of time, and it just leads to more idiocy because, it's just irrelevant, mm-hmm. really. She and her supporters are not irrelevant, but it is irrelevant the way it's being done. On the other hand, what Keith is saying, that we are facing a world of really diametrically opposed views about a lot of things. And a lot of what you see in the opposition to Barack Obama, whether it's coming from conservative or liberal end, is really fueled in a lot of ways by money. By the interest of big money, and it's being clothed in this populist cloak, it's what you were saying to me in the green room earlier, that when you look at what's going on with our public schools, that huge money, whether it's Bloomberg or Gates, are putting money into school systems and think tanks from right to left to push a certain agenda of how public education should be. Money is driving the discussion everywhere. The latest WikiLeaks that came out about genetically modified foods and how the links between Monsanto and what they want to do in the rest of the world and how our Foreign Service pushes it. I mean, and that's the problem. But here it's being cloaked in this populist kind of rhetoric, so that what goes for objective political debate. He's really a big business pushing the debate, and there is a divide.
Yeah, I'll only say this about the issues that were in the air in the last week to 10 days. 9/11 health bill, unemployment, don't ask, don't tell, even the DREAM Act, although perhaps there to a slightly lesser extent. Republicans were pushing hard in the Senate against most of the administration proposals. And, of course, the New START treaty. Polling wasn't, I don't think you can say from the polling that there was some uniform conservative movement out among people that were against. I don't think that's true. You have a Republican establishment that was pushing. It's a little hard to know what they were trying to do or what they were attempting to do or what their point was. On some of these issues, you don't have a stark divide on the people level. No, on some you do, but on those issues, not really. It's not clear. And people said all along they were never going to be able to hold off on unemployment because people, public opinion on unemployment benefits is strongly in favor of continuing
right.
and extending. It's not like on every issue liberal people and conservative people automatically disagree. And I'm just saying,
I agree.
There's
no
way to win unless you try to find ways to move to persuade, for liberals or progressives, to try to persuade conservatives or conservative leaners that in many ways we're all in the same boat. This is not, and that 1% is up there driving everything, including the media. And they're not on either one of our sides. They're not on the side of regular conservative people, and they're not on the side of regular liberal people.
And on the way back to the phone, LaToya, before you get up to the studios, you want to have a thought on that? Or is LaToya? She must be on her way up to the studios because she's not there. So let's go to the phones. Clarence, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mr. Steiner.
Hi, Clarence. Welcome. Good to have you with us once again.
Thank you. I call myself a layman, would term myself a layman in political, but I do pay attention. And it was interesting that I heard this buzzword on Anthony McCartney's show the other night called, the guest kept saying, physical responsibility. Now, me, as a layman, as I say, physical responsibility means this to me. When there is enough of the taxpayers' money in the coffers in excess, then that's something for me to draw upon to take care of my little projects for my constituents in wherever I was elected from. But when that money has to go to the whole of the country, such as social programs, to take care of the masses that really need it, then there's a problem with that. Then anybody that wants to spend money and point it in those directions for, like, infrastructure or things like that, then it has to be a big debate. And I would just wonder if your guests would comment on that statement. And I believe that's what drives a lot of the attacks and the just hostility that goes on in Washington today.
That's a very interesting point.
Now, what drives the hostility?
Clarence, lay it out in one sentence one more time. Clarence?
Yes.
Lay that out so Bob understands what you're saying in kind of very briefly in a sentence one more time to conclude that thought.
You mean what I just... physical responsibility, when I hear this term from coming from various facts...
Fiscal responsibility, right.
To me, that means that when there's an excess of the taxpayers' money, an excess of the taxpayers' money in the coffers, like when Bill Clinton left office, then that means there's a lot of money for me to draw upon for whatever projects that me and my constituents want back home. But when it comes, which in Washington's view is all right for each individual, but when it comes to spending money out of the federal coffers for social programs for the masses, then it becomes a big issue. If you want to spend money on social issues, then you're being physically irresponsible. And I think that's what drives a lot of the hostility in Washington between the different parties. Because when there isn't enough money there and you're spending it on social programs, then that leaves less for you to draw upon for your own little pet peeves or projects at home. I'm just curious about, you know, that point of view.
Well, there's definitely no money there right now. I mean, it's sort of comical to watch the discussion that's gone on in the last month. Now, here's another place where I've criticized liberals. We were very invested in opposing the so-called tax cuts for the rich, or the extending the Bush tax rates for income over $250,000. Now, I don't think that was a good idea. If I were emperor, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have extended the lower tax rates. I would have gone back to the Clinton-era tax rates for higher income. I'd like to see arguments about whether we should have gone back to the Clinton-era tax rates for everybody, but that argument really hasn't existed. But on our side, we spent a tremendous amount of energy on our fury about the idea that those lower tax rates would be extended for wealthier people. People got very mad at Obama. It's really... In terms of the gigantic deficits that are being projected, it's really not a lot of money. You know, I saw people on cable constantly saying it's going to blow a hole in the deficit. It really isn't. You know, I'm sorry. It's just not that much money compared to the gigantic amounts of money if we're ever going to actually confront our fiscal situation. But there was a tremendous amount of hostility which went at Obama over this. Now, I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong. I wouldn't have extended. If I were king, I wouldn't have extended the Bush tax rates. Obama didn't run for king, you know, and he didn't get elected king, and he isn't king. And that was a sort of an emotional, it seems to me, was sort of an emotional fury on our side, which really wasn't exactly connected to the actual size of the problem. And now what the question is being asked this week is, did Obama, by making that compromise, open the door for the victories that have occurred in the last week? If we were still fighting over that, if he had taken the advice handed him and said, well, you should keep fighting right down the line about that $70 billion a year If he had done that, would any of this stuff gotten passed in the last week? I don't know.
Well, I think
to me there was a lot invested there that was went beyond the size of what was done.
I think that the and one of the issues that Clarence Lothar was talking about, though, I mean, is that the debate in the media has been very narrow about this notion of fiscal responsibility and what is causing it and why it's here. And I think that that's part of the problem, that the debate is just not allowed or seen by the American people about what we have to do, so that we are kind of bullied by lack of information into a single position of what we're supposed to do. And I think that's part of our problem. The other part, I think that Barack Obama, some of it is at his doorstep. I think that the populist will is to take – there's a popular will in America to take on super wealth, whatever that means. And I think Barack Obama, the president, didn't fight hard enough in the eyes of a lot of American people, so the Republicans were allowed to take the populist thunder.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's his driving. It isn't something he seems to be drawn to.
And it,
on the other hand, I see no one really. The big story of the last 30 years has been the tremendous flow of wealth up to the top. You know, the top 1%, which used to get 8% of income 30 years ago, now gets 24% of income. That's just an astonishing change in the way our economy works. And I don't see anyone really explaining that. The American people don't know that. They don't understand about that. I don't see anyone trying to. I don't see anyone. I'm not going to put it all on Obama because, you know, the president can't be the person who explains everything to all those children. I mean, there have to be other entities. The conservative world is full of think tanks churning out all kinds of crap for the last 30 years. They don't just put a president in and make him do it all. And we don't have that in the liberal and progressive world. No one is explaining this to regular people, in my view.
Is LaToya on the phone? She's on the phone right now. She's coming up. Okay. So we're going to take a break so she can get in the studio here. When we come back from this break, we're going to go to Russ in Baltimore. Next caller, Mitchell's on the air and wants to come on, and Jeffrey wants to come on, Antoine. When you get these calls and their thoughts, 410-319-8888. We're here with Bob Summerby, editor of the Daily Howler. In a moment, LaToya Peterson will be in studio, editor of Racialicious.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And I'm going to posit something we come back with, is why I think it's, in some ways, in America, more class than race. I'll throw that out and see what you think. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here with LaToya Peterson, who made it through traffic from D.C. She left here like at 2:30 to get up here, and it's now 3 hours later. You just walked in the studio.
Thank you.
Cool,
thank
girl.
You.
It's good to see you.
It's good to see you, too.
LaToya Peterson is editor of Racialicious.com. You can connect from my website. She also substitutes for Michael Eric Dyson on his program. We co-hosted election coverage together from Busboys and Poets for Free Speech TV on election night.
That we did.
Which is where we decided we need to do more work together.
Exactly, which is why I took the epic trek down to Baltimore.
Bob Summerby, editor of the Daily Howler, who I have known for a long, long time and has been coming on the show since almost the beginning of the show, is here now. We're talking about the end of the year stuff. I'm going to go right to the phones, as I promised, to get our listeners in here. And let me posit this on the way out there, as I said I would. Race is a huge divide in America, and there's a gigantic portion of white Americans. Who knows, 30%, 40%, whatever that number is, that are freaked out that America's changing, its demographic is changing, and then we have this black man in the White House. We can't deny that doesn't exist in America. It's huge. However,
I'm not going to go with huge, but go ahead.
All right, that's okay. We can do the other part, though, is I want to reflect on 1968 for 1 minute and then go out to our listeners. When I was an organizer for the Poor People's Campaign, and Martin Luther King after he was assassinated. And we created Resurrection City in Washington, D.C., which was where thousands of poor people camped on the mall between the monument and the Capitol in our tent city. And it was black, and it was Puerto Ricans and Mexicans and Native Americans and Asians and white folks. And my job, along with these crazy, as they would call themselves, even though it's a derogatory term, hillbillies from Chicago, Appalachian whites, who had a program, who had their own newspaper called The Firing Line, had their own organization called the Young Patriots, which was like an Appalachian white Black Panther group in Chicago back in the day. And we organized working class and poor white people from Chicago through Ohio, all down in Appalachia, to come to Resurrection City. And in the middle of Resurrection City was an encampment of poor white working class men and women. They actually flew the flag of Dixie in that camp. Nobody cared.
Interesting.
Because it was this unity. Everybody was brothers and sisters, and they stood together. Which is, and what I'm saying with that is, there's a lot that can be overcome in America with the common cause you were talking about, Bob Somerby, I think, that we all face in America in terms of what we face from superpower of wealth and corporate power in America. And there's a lot of resentment to that in America, and there's a lot of other stuff that can be overcome in the face of that if we really work at it to bring it together. So I'm going to posit that. And I'll let you both comment on that in a minute, but let's go to the phones and get someone here. Then we'll throw that idea around and see what you think. 410-319-8888. Russ, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark, to you and your guests.
Welcome.
Mark, I think that, first of all, our attention span is so short.
Yes, it is.
In the last administration, we had a sitting vice president who told us for public consumption it wasn't classified, that deficits don't matter. Now, fast forward to Mr. Obama, everything he tries to do, what's the opposition? The deficit, the deficit, the deficit. I don't know how they can have it both ways. But I think further that what we're looking at today, is, as I hear everybody talking, is we're seeing a classic application of the Machiavellian principle of divide and conquer. You keep them in the dark, you feed them the bovine fecal matter, and you can carry on as a prince any way you like. I don't think there's going to be a change until we, the people, shake ourselves out of this self-induced coma that we're in and realize how much of a paradigm shift has already occurred. Because the only thing that we as Americans are still number one in is nuclear bombs and debt, and there's a question about the bombs because of the rise of China. A current example is the Europeans and the Euro is in trouble. They didn't come to the United States. They've gone to China. What does that tell you? But what I'd really like to say, Mark, is talk about jobs, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the jobs that used to be are no longer. They've been outmoded by computers, by robots, by just the fact that labor-saving devices have become prevalent. So we see a solution because we got crumbling infrastructure. We got bridges falling in America. Can you imagine that? Bridges falling in America, sounding like a third-world country.
Mm-hmm.
But what we need to do is get people busy with picks and shovels out there doing that kind of work because that's the only kind of labor-intensive stuff that we can do. Put the machines aside, give the people their picks and shovels, and let them rebuild America. We're good at that. But I don't know how to get to that point because, like I say, I think that, as your guest said earlier, there are so many factions and fractions who have their own agendas that how do you get people on the same page to realize where we are as a country, that we're borrowing 40 cents of every buck we spend, and by the year 2013, which, by the way, is the year that we're going to make the last installment on the debacle from the savings and loans in the 80s, and understand that by the time we make that last payment, the interest, now not the debt itself, but the interest on the debt is going to be equivalent to what we're spending a year for defense, $500 billion.
Russ, you raised some really powerful points. I'm going to let LaToya have at this first because she's back in the studio now.
And it works out. I'm not on my cell phone. No, I completely agree in terms of let's unpack the infrastructure comment quite a bit because I thought that was fascinating. In terms of, yes, let's put America back to work. You know, driving through Baltimore is always strange for me because I don't come here often. I don't have a car. And so either I have to get somebody to give me a ride or I got to deal with MTA, which I don't really like doing. And I'm riding through Baltimore, and I'm like, oh, my goodness, all of these houses are standing here vacant, all of these places in disrepair that would be wonderful homes for a lot of the homeless people that we see. Why isn't this connection being made? But at the same time, we talk about infrastructure, we talk about what we're building. We also have to talk about the investments we've been making in our human capital as a nation. Apprenticeship programs that used to teach people trades have largely fallen to the wayside. It can be very difficult to get into an apprenticeship program that will teach you, okay, this is how you can work with your hands, this is how you can build, this is how you can move forward. At the same time, you know, I work in the digital space. There's an entire digital jobs revolution going on. And the reason why I went to the Public Media Corps, which was a 6-month program that I went to sponsored by the National Black Programming Consortium, that was to encourage technology adoption in underserved neighborhoods. And I went back because I know there's tons of jobs here, but a lot of the kids coming up don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I came back to say, look, there are all these jobs here, but you still need the training. There's less training than with like a formalized 4-year college degree. But you still need to have someone showing you the ropes. You still need to know your stuff. You still need to learn how to become an entrepreneur online. You still need to figure all those things out. So I feel like there isn't that idea of investing in human capital, particularly when you look at the situation that we are in with student debt and colleges. It became this thing where, oh, if you want a good life, you go to college, without thinking of the hows or the whys, what skill sets people are bringing to the table, what type of jobs that we appreciate and we honor in the society, and which ones we don't. Despite the, you know, need for certain jobs over others. And so I feel like when we're talking about these things, it's really we're talking about making investments in people, which as a nation, it seems that we've been reluctant to do since the 80s.
I think that's true. And when I was with just in the other part of the infrastructure we have, I was with somebody the other night. Well, you were there. And he is an expert on infrastructure. We've been working in Washington, D.C. Won't mention his name until I talk to him and have him on the air. But he was saying to me, we have no idea what it's going to cost to rebuild America. The infrastructure, the water pipes, the electric infrastructure, the schools, we don't have a number, but it's huge. But it also is an investment we have to do or we're going to fall apart. And I think that, and there's a lot of economic thoughts, Joseph Stiglitz and others, who would say that's where America has to invest its money, and then it comes back in taxes, it comes back in investment in the marketplace, it comes back in jobs and puts America back on its feet like it did after World War II, and people go back to work. And I think all that needs to be thought through, and I don't think it is being thought through or even being talked about.
Yeah, I was going to say to the caller, forget about bridges falling down. It's even worse. We have football stadiums collapsing. So if that doesn't get us off our backsides, nothing will. You know, investments, it's just not the culture of the 1% anymore. You know, and here again, I'm going to take it back to the 1% versus the 99. Everyone has a sense that there was something very wrong with the way the bailouts were handled, et cetera, et cetera. Conservatives have a sense there's something wrong with that. The Tea Party has a sense there was something wrong with that. Liberals do. And, of course, there was something wrong with that. But that kind of looting of the society has been going on now for decades. And again, it hurts. It hurts all the 99. Everyone's getting ripped off except for the moguls. Liberals are getting ripped off. Conservatives are getting ripped off. And I just think we have to find a way, all of us, to build a horizon of understanding where people see that and where we stop seeing the world as red versus blue. And start seeing the world as 99% versus 1%, because that is the real war that's going on in the society, being disguised by a lot of red versus blue stuff, some of which is important, but a lot of which sort of is just entertainment or distraction.
410-319-8888. Mitchell, you're on the air.
Yes. Mussolini said, in Italy, he says, I don't know why they call this fascism. They should call it corporatism. He says, state and corporate power is what this is when he was talking about fascism. The only divide in America is between the people. There's no divide between Republican and a Democratic Party and the elite and the elite pundits. This last so-called lame duck section of politics showed that between the Democrats and the Republicans was kabuki theater and smoky mirrors. It cleared up something that I was wondering about. I think Barack Obama is the new black face of corporate fascism. And you know I'm not a extremist person. You know that, Mark.
I do know you.
My analysis is so scary. I think Barack Obama is the new legitimization, the black face of corporate fascism. With all the things that happened, you know what you were talking about with Monsanto and how the government sponsors that and protects those companies like that. And it's a very dangerous place that we're in. And we really need to wake up and see who these politicians are. And I agree with Bob I agree with him totally, but I think it's worse than we think about who Barack Obama is and who these politicians are. It's a very dangerous place that we're in.
I agree. It's troubling. And, you know, it's hard to mind read the individual. It's hard to mind read the individual politician. And I think Obama's relationship to these issues is troubling. But it's a problem of the entire Democratic Party. It's a problem of the entire so-called liberal world. Mark and I were talking before we came on the air about, and Mark mentioned it, the way Bill Gates's money being spent on educational issues, sort of corporatist educational ideas, and he may be completely sincere. I assume he is sincere. I assume he believes he's doing the right thing. But in Diane Ravitch's new book, she describes how Gates' money has gone to think tanks on the right, on the left. He's swamped every think tank with his money. They pander with their money to all the major pundits and journalists. It's created, and of course, the Washington Post is, well, it's a whole other story. It's created, this is just one example of the way big money is just all through our political and journalistic systems. In this case, by someone who may be trying to do the right thing, but it's just increasingly big money runs. It isn't just Obama. Big money runs the Democratic Party. It runs liberal think tanks, which ought to be challenging some of Gates's ideas, but have been taking his money for the last decade or so. And it's everywhere, and it's the rule of the 1%, or the one, in Gates's case, the 1/1,000,000th of the 1%. But of those people, way up in the 1%.
But I mean, at the same time, in order to talk about the 1% and to look at this as a, you know, a fractioning of the richest Americans versus everyone else and our livelihoods and what we're doing, there has to be an idea that there is common ground among those of us in the 99%. It's really hard to build a coalition if we're all extremely, extremely fractured. And so even if you're saying, oh, it's red, it's blue, that's how people have been able to deflect the ideas, because more people would rather still just go ahead and put their faith in this kind of ambiguous corporate, you know, free market, you know, the corporations will give us jobs because it's good for them, and hope for the best rather than looking at what's going on, because there are 1,000 other things competing for people's attention.
And I wonder how you think we get that attention. I mean, what is the response? I mean, when we see this going on, I'm trying to get a few more callers in here, but when we see this going on, I mean, what should be the response? What do you think the response will be in the next year? What do you think is going to happen in the next year?
I think that citizens have to become engaged to the point where they feel as though they can, one, make a difference, and two, where they feel not only accountable to themselves and the world they want to create, but also accountable to each other. And so, you know, you're talking about the tent city, and I'm cringing at the photo, like the Dixie flag flying. Like, oh, really? Like, this is where we're going to be?
I cringed at it too when I first saw it.
This is where we're going to be?
Right.
But whatever was said between the participants, they got to the point where, like, look, you're here, I'm here, but clearly we have this common interest and this common goal. I'm invested in you reaching your goal just as invested as you are in me reaching mine. And therefore, we can build from here. And once you have that common level of investment, that's when you can really do things and be powerful. But I don't think that investment is there, where people don't necessarily care what's happening to their neighbors anymore. People don't necessarily care as long as their lifestyle isn't compromised. And that's where a lot of these problems are coming in. There are larger grand inequalities that need tackling. But if we don't feel invested into each other, why would someone put forth that effort?
And we're stuck in our own myopic worlds often. Whether it's TV or reality shows or whatever those worlds are, we get stuck, and that becomes the way we release that energy rather than other ways. And we get stuck in these little worlds. There's a little sidebar to what you were just saying about Resurrection City. The guy I went with, his name was Doug Youngblood, and he was a hillbilly poet, he called himself, from Chicago. He had done 7 years in prison for manslaughter, had been a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and then became a revolutionary through his mother, Peggy Terry, and this stuff going on in Chicago, and flipped. That's the guy I worked with to organize through Resurrection City. When I saw, and I remember in the Civil Rights Movement, there was another guy who also came over after he participated in beating us up in the Eastern Shore. He came and became one of us. People can change. They come over because of their own self-interest to see something larger than themselves. I do believe it can happen.
I just think progressives are going to get nowhere until we find ways to look for people on the other side who can see the world in somewhat the same way, see the world as it's actually developing. And by the way, in terms of the next year, what's going to happen, I think we're going to find out what's going to happen in the next year when Obama gives the State of the Union address, where he will probably outline some new sort of idea of a new tax arrangement. And, you know, I don't think we're going to be arguing about the Bush tax rights 2 years from now. I think by then Obama and others will present a completely different tax structures, and that's where the real fight's going to start as to what is the justice in these proposals, how serious are the proposals, and how just are the proposals. And I just think the progressive world has to start paying attention late in January.
But at the same time, I think you start dropping the ball on these little things because they look like compromises. So, you know, one of the things we were talking about on the Dyson show this week was the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, which was signed to help get kids more nutritious school lunches. And so in order to add 6 cents to the average child's meal, every single meal, to have just a little bit more, a little bit better value, some more regulation of a la carte lines and things like that, they ended up raiding the SNAP program, the Federal Food Stamps program. And in one case, you're like, wait a minute, these kids who are on school lunch, it's because you're at or below the poverty line. So you're taking the food out of the mouths of the kids at home to give them food in school, which is kind of like hustling backwards. It doesn't seem to make much sense, but that was the compromise. And so when you're talking about this, you're like, wait, why did we take money from food stamps of all programs when, you know, we've got all these articles about record numbers of Americans applying and trying to get on it and figuring things out and trying to stretch their food budget. And it's the most effective social program that we have, at least according to Slate, looking at it in terms of what the stated aims of the program are and what actually happens. And yet at the same time, the question from the word back from Obama and the Democrats were, okay, we regret that compromise. Hopefully we'll get that money reinstated a little later. But there's always this idea that we must compromise on these very core progressive values in order to move things forward. But then the question is, moving it forward to what?
Well, it's not – I mean, in fairness, it's not always. And there were some actual real wins in the last week. But there's going to have to be a big new – proposal and a big new idea. The money is crazy going into the future. You know, taxes, revenues, income, outflow. There's going to have to be a big new tax proposal. It's just going to have to happen. Apparently, it's going to happen in the State of the Union, and that's when people have to really start to look and see what is actually being proposed. It's fairly easy to keep track of what's happening if we just say, will we keep the Bush rate or drop the Bush rate? This next thing's going to have 800 moving parts. It's going to be much harder to figure out who's gaining, who's losing, who's paying, who's looting. And I think at that point we're going to see, with respect to the last caller, is Barack Obama the black face of corporate fascism? I'm not sure, but I think that's when you'll start to see what is his real proposal.
We had Bill Shoren here from Share Our Strength yesterday and on the show, and there's $1 billion that states have not used that's sitting in the federal government because they won't pick it up to feed poor children in our schools. It exists. They're doing it in Maryland. But the other part is to change that, you have to do long-term. You have to invest in infrastructure, have to put people back to work so they can, A, feed their own children. So we have to put things – we don't have food deserts so poor working-class communities can go to the grocery store and buy inexpensive, healthy food to feed their families, which they can't do.
Exactly. All these things –
it's a long-term thing as well. It's not just these short-term fixes, which are always trying to plug the hole in the dike. You got to rebuild the bloody dike.
But then what ends up happening is that you get people who say things like, why should I be responsible for my neighbor's bad decisions, bad habits or whatnot? They don't look at it as an investment in the future. They don't look at it as, I'm investing in this kid having a safe and productive and healthy life. I'm investing in job training for people in prisons. I'm investing in this. It's as, oh, you're taking this away from me. I don't get this out in the world myself unless I pay for it. Therefore, everyone else should have to suffer in this way. And that's what you get in terms of, like, you know, the Republicans' discussion of having the private sector create jobs. The private sector hasn't been creating jobs. They've been hoarding their money. It's the banks. It's the large businesses, the large corporations. They're not hiring because they don't feel safe. Therefore, they're going to just keep holding on to that money while while they could be creating jobs here. That's not being a good corporate citizen, but that at the same time, that term is really loaded and it's really incorrect. But at the same time, I think you'll start hearing a lot more arguments, particularly next year, that the only person that can save us is not government, but corporations. And that's what's really terrifying.
Let me try to get a caller in here at 410-319-8888. Holding on a long time. Tony, you're on the air.
Thank you. When I look at the private sector, I look at the success of globalization. And with the success of globalization, I mean, we see new free trade agreements being generated by the U.S. government for these corporations to take advantage of new or no tech. So with that being the case, with companies taking advantage of it, they're taking advantage of low factors of production everywhere in the world. So as long as that is the case, and as long as we are out protesting against the free trade agreement, we're going to see our jobs be offshored and outsourced. And there's not going to be a return to normal employment in the U.S. So I don't really see the U.S. government really spurring job creation. I think we have to start focusing on these free trade agreements and having little protection as the U.S. bring jobs back to the U.S. Until that happens, we're stuck in this case of high unemployment.
Tony, you raise a really strong point. We have about 2 minutes left here on the air. Quick thoughts?
They say it's the new normal. The level of unemployment. And
it can't be.
It doesn't
have to be.
But in the next year, at some point we're going to have to start hearing what is the new proposal. And I don't mean tinkering with this little tax rate or that little tax rate. Someone has to start defining a new vision. I think there's going to be a vision offered by Obama now as to what it will come to.
On that day.
I don't know. I tend to think that in order to kind of fix some of these huger problems, there has to be a restructuring of what we consider as normal. And I don't think accepting this high unemployment rate as the new normal is the right way to do it. Let's look at the people who are out of work and what skills they need. Let's look at the companies that provide these skills in terms of, you know, what type of educational places can provide them, what places can be provided through an 18-month program, what places can be provided through a one-year program, what can be provided to get more Americans back to work, what can be facilitated to allow more people to participate in the digital revolution. I feel like that's the only two ways that people can get back on their feet.
LaToya Peterson, editor of racialissues.com. Bob Somerville, editor of the Daily Howler. I look forward to the next year with both of you coming back on frequently on this program. It's good to see you both.
Thanks, Mark.
Happy New Year, Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa, Happy Holidays.
Thank you.
To both of you and to all of you out there. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Division of Transplantation, where patients' lives are enhanced by a renowned transplant program known for innovation and excellence in kidney, liver, and pancreas transplants. For more information, 1-800-492-5538. And made possible by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Coming up next, a conversation with Brent Landau about his book, Revelation of the Magi, a newly discovered book he translated from the Syriac. He found the Vatican. Fascinating story and conversation. For this time of year. So stay with us again. Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa, Happy Holidays, Happy New Year to you all.